بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم، الحمد لله رب العالمين، والصلاة والسلام على أشرف الأنبياء والمرسلين محمد رسول الله صلى الله عليه وعلى آله وسلم تسليما كثيرا كثيرا. أما بعد، my brothers and sisters, I'm going to send you with this the link to a wonderful speech on by Geoff Colvin, the author of Talent is Overrated, and the speech is about his concept that talent is overrated and what he talks about, which is what we see as outsiders as a gift, as magic, as you know, all kinds of things. When you see an expert operating in his or her expert area, and we say, well, this is a God-given gift to that person, this person has superb talent and nobody can equal it, what we don't see is the hours and hours and weeks and months and years of practice, and not just of practice but of what he calls deliberate practice, and which I call thoughtful practice, which is the same thing with a little bit of value addition, which I'll explain to you in a minute, that goes behind this. So this talent, which we see as only talent, is not only talent. It is something which comes as a result of hard work. So this is Geoff Colvin talking about his own theory. It's fantastic. It's a set of three videos, about 11 minutes each. Listen to the first one, then the second one pops up, and listen to that in the third one. And as in his book, he gives many case studies, actual statistical data in proof and in defense of his theory. The most empowering and wonderful thing about this is that this means that you are not restricted by any gift of talent. Anyone can aspire to greatness. All it requires is seriousness with the approach. If you are serious enough to work for it, you'll get it. And I think that's a very inspiring and empowering thought. I want to talk to you about how important this is, the issue of thoughtful practice, from a different context, which is not just in becoming good at a particular physical ability, but becoming good in terms of overall our character. Now, the thing that Geoff Colvin talks about is, in terms of thoughtful practice, he talks about three. He didn't actually name those spheres or circles, but I'm naming them. Three circles that we operate in. One is the circle of comfort. So comfort zone, or three zones, right? The names are not important. It's to understand the concept. So the comfort zone. Comfort zone is the zone in which whatever you do, you know how to do it. You do it well. You're happy with it. You're within quotes customers, meaning those who see you, meaning those who benefit from your action and so on. They feel that they've got value for money, so to speak. And so this is your comfort zone. The second one is your stretch zone or your growth zone. And this growth zone or stretch zone is something where you are being compelled, again, not by force, but by an example, to do more than what you normally do. And how much more is a little bit more, not too much more. If you do too much more, if you attempt to do too much more, or you are inspired to do too much or forced, then you enter what is called the panic zone, in which you really learn nothing. You just go completely, panicked, and you get either paralyzed, you don't do anything, or you go nuts. But before that, the growth zone or the stretch zone, this is the most beautiful thing. This is the most valuable thing, because in this zone, you are learning. Now, one of the most wonderful quotes that I remember of all time is that no one knows the best that he or she can do. No one knows the best that they can do. The best is only what you did last. So you say, well, you know, can I jump 6 feet? Long jump, not high jump. You might say, yes, I can jump 6 feet. Now, somebody says, can you jump 7 feet? Our usual reaction to any statement where we are invited to do more than what we normally do is a negative. We say, oh, no, I can't do that. Can you lead this team? No, I can't do that. Now, if you break that down, and you should, and you say, well, why do you say you cannot lead this team? Oh, I never did it before. So if you never did something before, what is the data you have? The data you have is precisely that I have never done this before. Now, if I never do something before, does it prove I can't do it? No. All it shows is that I did not do it before, which is fine. So now, can I do it or not? What is my data? My data is I don't know if I can do it. So this is the most important, learning. To say that, it is not to say that I cannot do something, but to understand that I don't know if I can do it or not. So take the data. Stay with the facts. What are the facts? I don't know if I can do it. Fantastic. So now where do we go from here? I'm going to try. I'm going to try and see if I can do this. Do what? Do more than what I have done until now. And lo and behold, I find I can do it. So now what happened to the bar of my best? What is my best? My best has just now gone up to the extent that I exceeded my previous best. Now, this is something that you can do lifelong. Lifelong. And barring, and may Allah give all of you and all of us perfect health and all our faculties intact, but barring physical and mental illness and incapacity, we never know the best that we can do because it's not fixed. Every time we try, you learn that, I can actually do more than that. Now, that is the most important thing. So, comfort zone, and then we have the growth zone, and then we have the panic zone. There's no benefit in getting into the panic zone. Stay within the growth zone. So there's no benefit in staying in the comfort zone because you never learn anything. You're doing the same old thing over and over again. There is no benefit in getting into the panic zone because, again, you learn nothing. You just get panicked and, you're too busy running away in fear. The benefit is in staying in the growth zone, because there you are not panicked and you are being stretched. You're not being left alone to do whatever you thought you could do and be happy with that. No, you're being pushed. And you're being pushed to do a little bit more. Now, this is the beauty. This is the beauty of this wonderful approach. Now, that pushing is the first part of it. Second part of it, which is equally, if not more important, is now that I've decided to do a bit more, how must I approach that? How must I approach that? And you approach that thoughtfully. You approach that deliberately. It's not accidental. It's not sort of, my mind is somewhere, my thoughts are somewhere, and I'm just sort of pushing around, just mechanically doing something. No, I'm deliberately doing. I am aware of myself. I'm aware of what all my faculties, my strengths, my weaknesses, as I stand here. And then I am aware of the challenge that I'm faced with. And how will I approach that challenge in a way that is beneficial for me, right? Now, in Aikido, which I learned in the 90s, early 90s, in Bangalore, from my great friend and teacher, Julius Abe, there is a concept called centering. Now, centering, Julius always used to say, center yourself, center yourself. So before you go into a fight, before you start a series of moves and exercises, you should center yourself. Now, centering consists of exactly this. Centering consists of becoming fully aware of yourself as you stand there. Now, you'd be amazed how unaware we are, how much of a fog we live in with respect to ourselves, with respect to our surroundings, with respect to our own faculties, our own strengths. We live by default. We just, you know, you breathe and we work and so on. But when you center yourself, you have to first take a few seconds off and focus on yourself. And bring all your being, all your power, all your physical and mental and spiritual strength into yourself, into that moment. And then from that centered position, you move. And that move will be the most powerful move you make. Because it's coming out from that whole focus and reservoir of energy. But that will not happen if you don't center yourself, right? It won't happen if you are walking around in this fog of whatever is happening in your life. You have to center yourself. So this concept of centering from Aikido. You center yourself and then you move out of there into your activity that you're doing. So when you're practicing, it is this deliberate practice with every move that begins with centering yourself. I was learning golf in the late 80s. I wanted to play golf and someone gifted me with a golf set. And so now I had the golf set, I had my so-called desire to learn golf. And I didn't know how to play it. At that time I lived in the Mango Range in the Nilgiris, and the nearest golf course was the golf course of the Ooty Golf Course, the Ooty Golf Club, the Ootagamon Golf Club. Now, the Ooty Golf Club is very interesting. It is a, obviously because of the location of Ooty, it's mountainous, hilly. The fairways are very narrow. They are mostly on both sides. They are bordered by gorse, which, for those of you who don't know what gorse is an extremely thorny, very, very thorny, kind of bushy animal. It's not an animal, it's a plant, very thorny bush. Extremely thorny, it's full of thorns. Now, the reason why that's important is because if you hit your ball into the gorse, you're done. You either get a mulligan if you're playing on your own or a friendly match, so you're allowed another shot without penalties, or you lose, you get a penalty, so you get a stroke. So this was the problem with gorse. Ball gone is gone. Now, narrow, long freeway. So you had to learn how to hit straight. The other problem I had with my learning of golf at that time was that I had, first of all, a full-time job. I was in the tea plantations. And secondly, that I lived, Mangore, where I was living, I was living on Carolina State. Mangore Range is about 3.5 hours away from the Ooty Golf Club. So there was no way on earth that I could practice every day. Even getting there every week was sometimes a challenge because of work commitments and so on. And if I was going to play golf once in a week or less, there was no way that I was going to even learn golf. So what I did was, I persuaded one of the caddies from Ooty Golf Club to come and stay with me, to live with me. His name was Frank Augustine, and I owe him a lot. I used to call him Frankenstein. Frank Augustine. Now, Frank Augustine, or Augustine, was a wonderful human being. He was like maybe 5 foot nothing, maybe 5 foot one or something. He was scrawny, he was like a dried prawn. And the shot that he hit every single time, for the golfers who would understand this very well, it gave you that very fantastic, very satisfactory fut sound that you get when your club hits the ball absolutely square without any chipping, without topping, without going too much under or over, absolutely exactly in the center. You get this very satisfying fut. Now that is what Frank Augustine's, every single stroke of his did that. So here was this man who was physically, much less strong than I was. Physically, he was weaker than me, than I was. I'm talking about late 80s, so, you know, that's a long time ago. He was shorter than I was and everything else, weight and whatnot. Yet, my shots would struggle sometimes to go to 10 feet from where I was standing. And Frank Augustine's shot on the Ooty Golf Club would, not always, because the fairways were also long, but almost always, he would tee off from one green and the shot would land, the ball would land on the other green. And then he had to go and put it into the hole, where I would take maybe two, maybe three strokes to get there, so almost never on par. Now, what I did was I got him to come and stay with me. He set up a practice net, and then he came to me with a bag of, I think he had 100 golf balls in it. Now, these were balls that he had salvaged out of the gorse in Ooty course. So, you know, he had spent his time and energy and some blood, I guess, because, you know, to get them out of the gorse, you get scratched and bleeding. So he came with 100 balls. And my routine was, in the morning or in the evening, sometimes both, I had to hit 100 golf balls into that net. There was a big mango tree next to the net, and old Frankenstein would sit under the tree, and he would do what I called his chicken act. He would go cluck, 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 like, every time I hit the ball, not to his satisfaction, and believe me, he was doing that chicken act almost constantly. Now, even sometimes when I hit the ball fairly well, the most I would get out of him was about a grunt. I said, And then the next ball, he said. So what he was doing was, he was forcing me. He would say, concentrate, concentrate, concentrate. And I would concentrate, and I would hit, and I would hit wrong, and he'd concentrate again, and hit wrong. And what he was doing was exactly this. He was teaching me, first, making me aware of what could go wrong, and then pushing me to do better. And we did this for 3 weeks, every single day. And after that, we went to the Ooty Golf Club, and we played a full 19 hole course. We played the whole course, and I never became a champion golfer, but I could see the huge impact of this training. So I have Julius Abe to thank for his training in Aikido, and I have Frank Ongenstein to thank for my training in golf, both of which at that time, unknown to me, were really training in leadership, in excellence, and in learning about myself and my limits and the ability to push myself out of those limits. This is the benefit of thoughtful practice. And that is what I want to leave you with for today. Thoughtful practice. See the videos of Geoff Colvin. Thoughtful practice is what distinguishes the expert from those who are not. And it's not a matter of talent, it's a matter of thoughtful practice. وصلى الله على نبيه الكريم وعلى آله وصحبه أجمعين برحمتك يا رب.